Okay. This is the cause group?
Right.
Is there just one speaker?
Yeah.
Maricela? Okay.
So the arrow to the right moves it forward. Okay. Good evening, Chair and members of the board. My name is Maricela Morales, and I'm with CAUSE, the Central Coast Alliance, United for a Sustainable Economy. Our mission is to work with community and diverse groups to realize social, economic, and environmental justice. We're based in Ventura County, and starting last year, began to scale up our work to include the six-county Central Coast region, from Ventura to the south, up through Santa Cruz to the north. And so, hence, this actually became one of the first issues, aside from state redistricting, that we became involved in. And it's with great pleasure and also great concern that we are here with you tonight. So our focus as a social, economic, environmental justice organization is the people and issues of disproportionate negative impact, issues of, in other words, certain groups of people and specifically low income people of color that bear the disproportionate burden of poverty, of environmental racism. And so that is our interest in the ag waiver and the basis of the information that I'm going to share. So in the Central Coast, and for purposes of this presentation, the Central Coast is the five-county region from Santa Barbara to Santa Cruz, although some of the slides do include some information that includes Ventura County. And the issue of contaminated water, and that's been brought before you by other speakers. But the point here is to expand on the concentration of it, specifically in low-income and communities of color. I want to give a special thank you to the USC Program for Environmental and Regional Equity, from whom we obtained some of this information. And the lead professor there is not someone unfamiliar with the Central Coast. He used to be a professor at UC Santa Cruz. So the Central Coast, and this is one of the slides that does include Ventura County, it represents 8% of the state's total land area, 15% of the state's organic cropland, 17% of the state's total farmland, and yet it represents 26% of the state's crop market value. So it's actually in an area that is very wealthy, at least in assets and value in terms of agriculture. So you would think that if such wealth is concentrated in the Central Coast, that perhaps we would see the benefits of that in terms of food security for the community in this region. And the reason why I bring up food security is because one of the basic elements of looking at environmental justice is this concept of cumulative impact, which means that when looking at any issue and its disparate impact, it's relevant to take into account other issues that also weigh in on that community. You know, it's one thing if you're poor, it's another thing if you're also, you know, food insecure, and it's another thing if you also don't have access to transportation, and another thing if, you know, your public schools are, it's that cumulative impact that is of, you know, added concern and of relevance. So, hence, this slide. So the Central Coast, 26% crop value on a per-person basis compared to California as a whole. It's about four times in the Central Coast the value on a per-person basis. Again, lots of wealth. But in terms of food security, we're in the Central Coast at the same place. So here we are in ag region, all of us ag in our community, and yet we're not reaping the benefits of the fruits and vegetables grown here. So that shows food security amongst adults is essentially the same compared to the state as a whole. Food security amongst children, which is worse than that of adults. No, that's the opposite. Is about the same compared to the state. Okay, so the issue of food justice within this region, okay, is one of those cumulative issues that adds to the water issues in this region. So environmental challenges. It was pointed out by one of the other speakers in terms of some specific toxins or pesticides. This is overall California pounds of pesticides applied by county. And so clearly the bulk of it is in the Central Coast and Central Valley. But as we can see there, you know, Santa Barbara, Monterey County are the heaviest, along with Ventura, in terms of pesticides. And this is long-standing and hence, you know, the problems with our water quality. I want to point out the circle in terms of the demographic composition of workers in agriculture. So the very communities that are disproportionately negatively impacted in the Central Coast includes those workers that work in agriculture, and the vast majority of them, 86%, are Latino. So here we really get to this disproportionate impact and the seriousness of it. 82% of the worst water quality sites are in the Salinas and Santa Maria areas. So this is from the February 1st, 2010 staff report. So again, 2 years ago today, exactly. 82% of the worst water quality sites. So your board oversees a 300-mile stretch, 1.5 million people. And of that 300-mile stretch, 82% of the worst water quality are in Salinas, in two spots, Salinas and Santa Maria. All of the most toxic water sites are in Santa Maria and Salinas. All but three of the most toxic sediment sites are in Santa Maria, Salinas. Of the impaired water body listings, 68% of the polluted drinking water bodies are in Salinas, Santa Maria, and the Bajaro River area. So, and compared to 5 years ago, and now more than 5 years ago probably, it's getting worse, it's not getting better. Now we're going to get to, okay, so.
Excuse me, before you get off that slide.
Yes.
Of your 5 points there, can you tell me which are drinking water and which are surface water?
That's a good question. Maybe I can help with that.
The top of the slide says drinking water.
It's because those impaired water body listings refer only to surface water. That would be surface water bodies that are designated within municipal drinking water beneficial use, not groundwater bodies that are currently that currently have wells that we know are being served for public drinking.
So all of that is basically
surface water?
Water.
All the rest, yeah, all of that is surface water.
Okay, thank you.
And with the exception of the 68% of the polluted drinking water bodies, I'm pretty sure that's surface water also. Okay. Okay, so who are in those areas? But, you know, actually, let me go back to that and reference a couple other things. So in Santa Maria, in terms of nitrate levels, the 2008 water quality report, during 2008 there was a surge of nitrate levels at City Well 7, 9, 10, and 14. Well 7 was not activated into the system. So that's from the city's 2008 water quality report. So the level of nitrate contamination in the city of Santa Maria is extremely high. As a comparison, in Santa Maria, the ranges of nitrate levels were between 2 and 78 parts per million, whereas just south of Santa Maria, also in Santa Barbara County, in the city of Santa Barbara, the highest level was 2 parts per million. So again, the great discrepancy. And then from the Monterey County Environmental Health, these were from public records of 2009 and 2010. They had done, I guess, a series of sampling and found that 83 water systems had nitrates over the 45 mg per liter of the legal limit. That represented 16% of the wells. And over 20 water systems had nitrates of over 100 milligrams. So the nitrate issue is of great concern and very, very high, again, in these two areas, Salinas Valley and Santa Maria specifically. So digging a little bit deeper, so who lives in these communities? Okay. The Central Coast, it's about 48% people of color, Latino, Black, API, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American. By far, it's Latino. Okay. We went ahead and included other people of color, but overwhelmingly, it's Latino. Again, Central Coast is about 1.5 million. Your Central Coast, as in from Santa Barbara through Santa Cruz, is about 1.5, 1.4 million people. So Salinas Valley, though, again, looking more closely, you have communities that are almost essentially 100% Latino, people of color. I mean, it's predominantly Latino. 100%. These are the communities that are in the most contaminated areas. Gonzales, 91%. Greenfield, 93%. And so forth. Santa Maria is the least concentrated, and that's at 77%. So for us, you know, the Environmental Justice Executive Order, it's a federal order. It's premised on two laws. It's premised on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it's also premised on the National Environmental Policy Act of 69. So from our perspective, this is a civil rights case. We have a region where 1 out of 2 are Latinos, essentially, people and other people of color, and yet the areas that have the most egregious and most contaminated waters are anywhere from 77% to 98% Latino and people of color. That, to me, smells of a civil rights case. 300-mile stretch, numerous cities, and yet the concentration of contamination is where all the brown people live. So, again, to cumulative impacts. Because it's one thing if all these folks were like George Lopez, who lives in Monterey or has a home, right, in Carmel or somewhere, right? They were very wealthy and had, you know, resources to pay every day for, you know, gallons and gallons of bottled water and what have you, pay the $5 million for the county to open up a new. If that was the case, okay, they've got resources. But it's not the case. Now, this is in terms of the percent change in household income in the region. And as you can see, the lowest percentiles, 10th and 20th percentiles, have, and even 50th, have seen a decline in their real household income, as opposed to those already in the 80th and 90th percentile of income seeing, you know, some increase during that period. So these communities of the Salinas Valley and Santa Maria are not in the 80th and 90th percentile as a whole. Okay, I'm sure there's people there that are, but as a whole, they're not. And so these are folks that are low income, low wage working, they're working, and not only are they low wage workers, but they've seen their household income decline. So this is a map that just shows sort of in visual form, and the lighter the color, you know, the less income in this case. And so you can see the Santa Maria is fairly light, and the Salinas Valley is fairly light as well. So this is in the actual median income. In amongst the Central Coast, it can range, you know, from 58,000 to 66,000 in terms of median income on a county basis. And median income then, you know, meaning you can have 50% earning less, 50% earning more. So Salinas Valley, all under the median income. Santa Maria also under the median income. So we're talking about low income areas that are bearing the burden of the poor water quality and even the surface water in their area, and that are having to, you know, pay more, such as the community of San Gerardo. So the gentleman that was here, I mean, he mentioned, you know, having his water bill go to $100, $150. For some people, that might not be a big deal, right? They've got a fairly, you know, good income. But for a community that's making far below the median income, for a low-income community, that $100 is a lot of money. It's not money that they have, but somehow they have to eke it out. So, having said all of that, our main point, our recommendation then, is not to delay. Not to delay. You've heard that from others. Enough delay is enough. And to the often quoted quote of Justice Thurgood Marshall, justice delayed is justice denied. And with communities like those in the Salinas Valley and Santa Maria, every day that goes by, they are that much farther away from having the type of basic protections from things getting any worse. You know, the ag community is concerned of the tenuousness of the future, but it's today and yesterday that these communities have lived with the reality of the situation. For them, it's not a theory of maybe or what if. It's, no, this is what's been, what they've had to live with, and what they're having to live with every day. So do not delay. In March, make a decision. Take action. It's a step forward. We've got a long way to go, but at least it's one step forward. Our recommendation would be to adopt staff's ag waiver draft, and preferably the most aggressive one, the February 2010 order, because from that perspective, it's doing most to address environmental justice for low-income, low-wage working families. And so I have up there what we define environmental justice to be, as equal and fair access to a healthy environment, and that includes equal enforcement of environmental regulations, protection for environmental hazards, and even elimination of inequitable environmental burdens for communities of color and low-income communities. So with that, I'll conclude if you have any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Delgado.
Yes, thank you, Maricela. I know San Gerardo is a probably one of the worst case examples, right? But in toward the conclusion of your presentation, you were saying that today and yesterday, these communities are living with basically the consequence of something, and I wasn't sure what. Are you saying that they've been living with polluted drinking waters, or what are you saying that they've been living with that's bad as far as water?
Well, in my point towards that is that if they're not at the place where the community of Sunderland Outdoor is, that they're certainly at risk of getting to that place. And that's why I brought up the issue or the specific example of Santa Maria, where they had level of surge in nitrate levels, which then required not activating certain wells. And so those are indicators that they're getting to places where either the city is having to, pay additional to, clean the water in order to make it, available to the public, and that those costs then, ultimately, end up getting pushed to the community. That even those consequences of higher public water costs are ones that they're having to bear.
Thank you.
Any other board questions? No? Dr. Hunter? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Okay. That concludes the prepared presentations, and we'll go to our speaker cards. I've got 15 of them, and no more cards, okay? I want to close that off. If anyone else does want to speak and hasn't given me a card, please give it to me right now, because, we all want to get out of here at some point, and I want to draw the line with that. So I want to give everyone the 3 minutes, and we'll start with Sarah Damron, Gail Delahunt, Kay Mercer, and then Alice Grip, those four.
Sarah left.
Yeah. Gail Delahant with Western Growers. Welcome, new members of the board. I represent Western Growers. We're an association of about 2,600 members who grow, pack, and ship fresh fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts. And I'm here just to tell you that we're in support of Farmers for Water Quality's proposal and hope you would consider it seriously. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Kay?
She stepped out for dinner.
Okay. I'll put her on the bottom of the stack in case she returns. And then after Ms. Grip will be Andy Caldwell. And then Richard Quant.
Hi. I'm Alice Grip. I'm a farmer and a geologist. And flooding is very, very bad for water quality. And during a sequence of closely spaced storms, the application of rule number 35 increases the likelihood and severity of flooding. And rule number 35 requires the control or treatment of the first inch to inch and a half of rainwater during each storm. And the rule makes sense. I'm applying it at my farm now. For the widely spaced storms that occur at the beginning of the season and towards the end of the season. We do that already at my farm. But sometimes we get, not this year, but you get 5 or 10 storms piled up and they come in. Maybe there's 5 minutes between them. Maybe there's half a day. The water gets really saturated. And I think rule number 35 needs to be made a little more complex to avoid flooding then. So when you get in the middle or end of a long series of storms, the ground is saturated and there's way tons of runoff. And the release of that impounded half to 1 inch at the beginning of the storm that you're treating or whatever you're doing, it gets shifted to the middle when you've just got tons of water coming through and could lead to increased chance or severity of flooding, which I think we all saw from Katrina is very bad for water quality. And also after we've had several storms in a row, the system gets pretty flushed out. And so unless someone had applied chemicals or, dug up stuff, there really isn't any reason to... there's not really a significant improvement in water quality to make for that really horrific amount that you're going to add into the stream system. And I'm also wish you would consult the flood control districts about this thought, and you know, the Army Corps and the USGS might have inputs on it, because they have data of storm data from years and years, decades, that they've used to help predict if there a flood might happen. They look at it, and if you've got all these farmers holding back the first half or inch, and then we all get there at 8 in the morning and release our whatevers, you know, it's all going to go in there, and it's going to be difficult for them to predict flooding, which is very, very bad.
Thank you. Hold on 1 second.
I sent an email to Angela, too, but I didn't realize it was, like, illegal. I'm sorry. Burn it.
Why is it illegal?
Because of the testimony thing.
You can send emails to Angela,
Okay. I only send it to Angela.
Okay. I just wanted to ask staff, can you put up Rule 35 pretty quickly?
I can read it.
I need to see it.
Okay.
Do you have it on a hard drive? Well, I'd like everyone to be able to see it.
Okay.
So that we know exactly what mm-hmm. you're talking about. And then while...
Do other people want to talk? That's great. I don't like public speaking at all.
You did very well. We may have questions for you. I don't want you to leave. While Lisa's doing that, Angela, I have a question for you. Can you access the DPR list of pesticides of concern? Do you have that somewhere? Does staff have that somewhere? The master list that has... Yes.
List of 75 or so pesticides.
I have no idea what's
in the beginning.
I'll try to do that.
Okay. I mean, is that on that hard drive, not this one?
It would be on this one.
Yeah.
Lisa's getting the 35.
Good. I saw 35 there.
That's finding.
Oops, too far.
How many 35s do we have?
Yeah. Thank you.
Rules and findings.
Heard sections.
Rules.
Yeah. I thought it was footnote 35.
It's on page 19 of attachment 1.
Okay.
Lisa.
I was in the wrong attachment. Is this the right attachment? Oops.
It's really short. I can read it.
Attachment 1.
Your attachment 1, so page 19.
Keep on going. Page 19. Keep on going.
Anyone else want to drive?
Two more.
18.
One more.
This is darn exciting.
There it is.
Come on. Okay. So, dischargers. Can you make it larger?
All of this process is lifted, you know, add a phase shift to the flow and make it more
source control.
She's talking about peak discharge in a stream.
Stormwater.
Well, you even got wrong the next inch.
Right. So what does happen under the scenario that Ms. Grip is describing? I mean, is this this rule then going to set off something that's going to have a worse consequence than without it?
Well, the basis of the rule is that first sentence, right? Is to prevent, is to implement source control and treatment management strategies to prevent erosion,
right,
reduce stormwater runoff quantity and velocity, and hold fine particles in place. The next sentence is actually, it's existing from, first of all, it's from the 2004 order, and it's also standard in our stormwater practices, and it's a way to evaluate the performance of the management practices.
Right.
I am not familiar with a situation where doing so would result in flooding. I'm having a hard time envisioning what she's describing. So, which I don't... If you could restate your question, Chairman Young.
It sounds like only the first half inch of rain of each storm needs to be controlled or treated.
But it's not going to be like that because I not want me or my workers to
Can you come to the microphone? Thanks.
I don't want my farmers to come to attend at night in the driving rain, cross fields. You know, it's all going to get done at 7 to 8 in the morning. We're all going to pull our wetsits up. And so I think it says, control and treat and further reduce runoff so that it sounds like you want
to
have stuff.
Why do you have to pull anything?
Oh, I'm sorry. So at my farm, we have, I'm not a trained farmer, I'm a trained geologist. We have this waterway and it gets diverted into our sump and it gets redispersed on our non-growing grounds where there's grass and stuff to help filter it. And so when we've had a good, we've got a series of storms, we pull this
sluice gate.
See, there's a person who has a degree in agriculture, a sluice gate. And then the water runs through, so we've got the subsequent half inch, let's say, running there. But then we also have all of our, the water we've applied to our fields, which will slowly, because the ground is saturated after a few storms, is percolating out and running off. And it's all going to come during the peak rain time, which, it's widely spaced like our rain this year. It's not an issue. It's when you get tons of Pacific storms stopped up, backed up, and, they're dumping 3 inches, 5 inches in a day. You do not want any more system. You want it to get as much water out before the maximum rainfall event happens.
But aren't you going to be doing that? I mean, it's only the first half inch.
Well, also talked about the next inch, too. And I'm saying that in practicality, I do not want to have to be walking through a field at 10 at night, which is just dangerous for human beings, and pulling out the sluice gate. So it's all going to happen at when we all get to work at 7, 8 in the morning. So it's all going to get released. It's going to mess up decades of storm stream gauge measurements that flood control people have based their flooding predictions on.
Gotcha.
So I'm just worried, we'll know who to blame.
Well, I would just suggest you have staff look into it and talk to her and see if there's any way to clarify it.
Talk to me. Talk to
whoever.
Flood control district people who have PhD. I'm a volcanologist.
We can look into it. The intent of this particular condition was not to anticipate containment, as she describes. It was management practices related to infiltration to prevent
maybe
erosion.
You could talk to her about this so you can better understand.
I'd rather she talk to someone at the U.S. Geological Survey or flood control things.
Okay.
Do you have, can you suggest someone?
No, but there's probably Salinas Flood Control District.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Caldwell. Then Mr. Quant. Then Mr. Groot.
Chairman, members of the board, I'm Andy Caldwell representing CoLab. CoLab is a coalition of labor, agriculture, and business. We represent about 2,000 members in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. The question before you today is what is actually going to work in the real world? This is not an easy problem to tackle because it's not a point source, it's a non-point source. And there are so many variables, and some of these variables are beyond the control of the landowner or the farmer. You've got issues of depth to groundwater that are not the same region-wide. You have a patchwork of ownership. You have a patchwork of crops. Some of those same crops may be planted on different days and almost every day throughout the growing season. You have the different growing cycles. You have the wild card of temperature, and you've got the wild card of rain that changes everything in terms of what was applied, when you apply it, and how much gets retained. What we wish your staff would do and what your board would do is create a pilot project to see if what they're proposing would actually work and whether it's economically viable. And one of the other hearings, I think it was Commissioner Jeffries asked the question, well, does this mean in some places we won't be able to grow vegetables or strawberries? And the answer from staff is yes. So you're talking about perhaps wiping out the major crops grown in this region, and this is one of the only regions in the entire United States that we can grow these crops. That's what's at stake here. We want to know what is actually going to work. The farmers don't know. That's why they're hiring PhD types to come up, try to come up with the plan. There's also these legacy issues. What the professor said earlier is what's going on in the surface right now may not even be contributing to the nitrate loading. I used to work at Sinton and Brown, which is part of Union Sugar's industry in the Santa Maria Valley. We had 50,000 head of cattle at our feedlot. There were over 100 dairies in that valley. There are no dairies today, and the feedlot's gone. But the nitrates are still there. And I beg to differ with the lady from CAWS. Santa Maria's on state water. Santa Maria's been on state water for years. I would rather you bring in the City of Santa Maria wastewater management person or their public works director to tell you what the status is. And I could also tell you some of those areas where there's quote-unquote impacted wells, there's no ag in those areas. What is actually going to work? We don't believe that your staff, we believe your staff approach is, here's the problem, clean it up, or we're going to fine you.
Can you wrap it up, Mr. Caldwell?
Issue of environmental justice, our food supply and jobs in agriculture are also at stake here. And you can't forget, we're talking about our nation's vegetable supply. And we believe that your staff proposal won't work. Let's create a pilot project in areas where there's an actual problem and work on that, as versus this region-wide shotgun approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Quant, Norm Groot, and then Gordon Hensley.
I'm Richard Quant. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Grower-Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo Counties. I was on the Agriculture Advisory Committee for this waiver and for the 2004 waiver. And I'd like to kind of weigh in a little bit on that since there's been some testimony. I think those of us that were part of that 2004 waiver and had leadership positions in agriculture readily saw some of the shortcomings associated with that waiver. And some of those shortcomings involved uneven progress in the ag community. We came into those discussions with the idea we need to address the accountability issue and make the 2004 order work. But unfortunately, we never got a chance to have that discussion because of the five bullet points that were submitted in Mr. Briggs' letter that came to the Ag Advisory Committee, and that dominated the discussion of the Ag Advisory Committee, and we basically wound up talking right by each other, and that's why those discussions, I think, broke down. And I would suggest in the future, if you're going to have advisory committees for other things, you refrain from, you know, submitting letters like that. During the process, the one thing staff was consistent in saying is that we're open for discussion on the milestones for compliance. And I would like to just leave you with to look at those on table 4 in the time schedule for milestones set forth on page 38 and 39 of the draft order. And there's three milestones. One of them deals with toxics. One of them deals with a reduction in sediment load. And the way those are couched, if by October 1, 2015, the farmer can't show a 75% reduction in sediment load relative to October of 2012, you violated the order. You're not in compliance with the times with the time frames. And so I think if you're going to look at that table, you need to look at the language that's being submitted in terms of the time frames for the Tier 3 dischargers, because the fear out there in the ag community is if you don't meet these numeric water quality standards in those timelines, most of them, the two that will kick in October of 2015, you're going to be dragged into an enforcement proceedings by the water board, and you're going to have to prove yourself innocent. If that's not staff's intent, that should be clarified. I might suggest that in 2004 order, there was a section called FAQs that was included in the order that had questions and then staff's intent to try to clarify for the regulated community what actually the intent of the language was in the order. That was very helpful in the 2004 order. Something along those lines would be very helpful to move this process along. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any reason why we don't have the frequently asked questions, the FAQs?
One reason is probably because we put out so many staff reports summarizing what these issues are and how we've responded in numerous pages of response to comments and transparency and availability of all the comments that were made, as well as met in those numerous public meetings and repeated some discussions about some of these issues. That's a pretty common one that seems to continue to be misunderstood in spite of the fact that we continue to clarify that those are not effluent limits and nobody would be in violation for failure to meet them. They're indicators of progress.
Okay, Mr. Groot.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I know you said this comes up a lot, and we've heard it a few times tonight, this issue of having a requirement by a certain date, and the question is by the growers, what happens to us, the growers, if we don't meet those? And there was a section we looked at earlier where basically it says that it would be evaluated according to various criteria. And so I think it implies it's left to the discretion of the board and or the executive officer to use those various criteria to decide what to do if a grower doesn't comply with any one or combination of these items. But it seems to leave a lot of room for question and worry for a grower who is being asked to meet multiple milestones, any one of which could bring the grower into the board's discretion to decide what to do about it based on various criteria that would be interpreted with some discretion by the board or the executive officer. So it does seem appropriate to have some language written in here that maybe better describes the process. The way that we've heard it addressed tonight is verbally, you're not in violation, you're just not in compliance. And it doesn't mean that there's going to be any punitive measures. We're going to take a look at it when it comes forward. And it just, verbally it's getting better, but even verbally it's still left a little bit, I think, too uncertain for someone who's expected to be compliant with this to feel very comfortable about it.
This is kind of the fear factor I was mentioning earlier. So I think what staff should do is just lay out what regulations or policies you follow when there's a provision and a permit that, quote unquote, is being violated. What do you do? Okay, there's a State Water Board policy on enforcement. Maybe that should be an attachment or reference somewhere. But I think people need to know what's going to happen, because there's a lot of perception, accurate or not, that the shoe's going to drop on them right at that point. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, but you're going to go through a process of evaluation, I think you should have something that describes what that is.
And I wonder if staff, at least for my benefit, could take this one example of a 75% reduction in turbidity or sediment load and describe what is the intent If it's not, if someone's not compliant, you know, what do you expect will happen?
I don't think you need to do it now, but because there's a package here of information that you should give to us before.
But just in general, short, we would expect them to, or we would expect the discharger to evaluate their discharge, what's causing it, and to adapt, to look at what the practices they're implementing, are they working or not, and if they're not, what else can we do? It's similar to what Dr. Los Huertos described. It's an adaptive procedure where you measure your discharge against with the impairment in the receiving water. And if the discharge is contributing, we continue to make improvements.
And I want to say it's addressed in paragraph 10 of attachment 1 of the order, of the proposed order, which says this order requires compliance with water quality standards. And then it goes on to say, consistent with the Water Board's policy for non-point sources, dischargers comply by implementing improving management practices and complying with other conditions, including monitoring and reporting requirements. So right in the order it says, you comply by doing this, which is to implement your management practices, comply with other provisions of the order. And to me, that's explaining what we mean by, and that's consistent with other regional boards' way of addressing it. But we'll look and see if it needs more clarification, but that's...
I'm reading the same language, and what it doesn't say is, and it doesn't seem like a lot more words, it doesn't say if you fail to meet the standard but are continuing to improve. Yeah, it doesn't say anything. It says you comply by doing this, but it kind of... It indirectly says what you're saying, that's compliance, but it's immediately following something, a first sentence that says it requires compliance with water quality standards.
Right.
I mean, it seems like, and maybe there's a legal problem with stating that more clearly, I don't know.
Well, it goes on to say, if the discharger fails to address impacts to water quality by taking actions required by this order, including evaluating the effectiveness of their management practices and improving as needed, the discharger may then be subject to progressive enforcement. So it says, you first do these things, implement your practices, show us you're doing it, show us that they're working. Then if you don't do that, then you're subject to progressive enforcement, which is our enforcement policy. I mean, if you're asking to say you're not going to be out of compliance if you never meet water quality standards, I mean, that's, you have to require compliance with them, and then the non-point source policy specifically says you comply with for non-point sources by implementing management practices. So that's what this says to do, and it's direct.
It is just confusing because the very first sentence of the paragraph is the order requires compliance with the standard.
Right, and what the standards are receiving water standards. In other words, the receiving water, meaning the stream or the groundwater, is supposed to achieve the basin plan water quality objectives. If they don't, the board, would have to prove that, first of all, that they don't meet, and second of all, who's causing them not to meet the standards. You'd have to go look, then you'd go look and say, oh, it looks like right here that's what's causing the problem. You would go look at that farmer. Are they implementing their management practices? Yes or no. Have they done the other things in this order? Yes or no. If the answer is no, they haven't done it, then the likely enforcement is, here, you need to do this. Here's, you know, some kind of a order, cleanup and abatement order, some kind of time schedule, do some more. Then maybe after progressive enforcement, you could come to some monetary penalty, but it would be after steps.
Yeah,
and that part could be described. I mean, it's described in the enforcement policy, but I think there's, you know, this is what every person who discharges waste to waters of the state are subject to the requirement to comply with water quality standards. This doesn't impose effluent limits. Effluent limits are end-of-the-pipe limits that then would be, you violate an effluent limit, you're subject to a penalty immediately. That's not...
Maybe the simple limits. Statement that goes in there then is, these are not effluent limits where you violate the limit at the end of the pipe, you're subject to enforcement.
Right.
Rather, and then the rest of the statement as to what happens if you fail to address.
Yeah, and that's what we can look at clarifying, but it can't be somehow you don't have to meet water quality standards. I mean, that
it
you have
to say that.
Right, yeah.
Could I add to that?
Sure.
Just that, you know, they complain about it's subject to judgment, it's too fuzzy and that sort of thing.
Discretion.
And Subject to discretion. And if you really want to eliminate that discretion, that leads to effluent limits.
Right.
And I don't hear anybody saying we should have effluent limits. So that's why we're trying to figure out a way to allow that flexibility for demonstrating good faith efforts, implementing best management practices. That, of course, involves some judgment in terms of how that's being carried out. And ultimately, that comes back to the board. If there's a problem with that.
Well, we understand that.
Right.
Francis does, you do. I mean, most of the public really doesn't understand that process. We're just
right, and
requesting
we can provide
more language clarification, mm-hmm. something about what does progressive enforcement mean, and then refer to whatever policies that staff just implements in determining
and
what to do.
The area that I think can be more clarified a little better is that the non-point source policy also provides for having schedules. And I think a good point was raised that the schedules, it may not be clear how the schedules apply to everybody on the all three tiers. So I think that's another area we can look at describing how enforcement happens, and we can look at how to be more clear about schedules.
Okay. And maybe just include the statement, this isn't an effluent limit where under which, if you're exceeding the limit, you're subject to enforcement immediately. This is something different. Just trying to make
that
okay. Mr. Mayor, I see you're ready to. Not this Mr. Mayor, that Mr. Mayor.
Now I'll ask you.
Oh. Okay, Mayor Delgado.
This reminded me of something that was another speaker brought up, basically talking about the potential loopholes of making it fairly easy. I don't know what to say, just making it possible for Tier 3 dischargers to be able to move into Tier 2 or and
the pesticides.
Yeah, and so I just want to know.
That's why I want that table.
I'm sure staff has probably gone over this 100 times, but does staff have any concern about that?
We've asked them that before, so because you weren't with us, you didn't have the benefit of hearing that answer. So do you have the table available?
I do have the table.
Can you project it? Because it's an important point. You know, that was a concern I had, that out of like 75 pesticides, only two are being targeted. And does this encourage someone to get off of the two and go to one of the others? Staff has a response for that.
It was Ben's presentation. Yeah. Thank you, Ben. Yeah. He's still here.
And we actually responded to that question, I think, back in May. We had a slide prepared. I won't try and go through all the slides now to find it. But we did evaluate the possibility, for example, of adding additional pesticides to that list other than just chlorpyrifos and diazon. At the time, we did not prioritize doing that because most of the toxicity on the Central Coast is caused right now by chlorpyrifos and diazon. And we had improved the cooperative monitoring program pesticide list. It actually had never included individual pesticides with the exception of follow-up. So now the cooperative monitoring program receiving water monitoring includes this whole slew of pesticides. So we can detect now with greater, in a more timely way, which pesticides are being detected in the receiving water. And while looking at that data with the DPR pesticide use data, we can try and determine where the issues are. The order also includes the ability for, used to be the executive officer, has since changed to the board in response to ag comments, that we can evaluate pesticides for inclusion in the tiering. So if the board decides that it's insufficient, there are additional causes of toxicity due to pesticides that are not currently listed in the tiering criteria, we can put those into the tiering criteria. The board can choose to do that.
During the five-year period?
At any time. Right.
And I think what staff had also told us before was that the reason they're aware that other farms are using the other pesticides, but if those pesticides were pulled into this tiering, that it would force many smaller farms to be elevated in the tiering, and you didn't want to do that?
Not just small farms. It would bring a whole lot, many, many farms of the various tiers into Tier 3, and there was not yet evidence like there was for chlorpyrifos and diazinon that it was the primary cause of toxicity. Now, I'm not saying that other pesticides are not the cause of toxicity, but not at the same level and severity that chlorpyrifos and diazinon are. Another reason, Chairman Young, was that the individual discharge monitoring of the Tier 3 farms, you may recall, includes toxicity. And so it's not just chlorpyrifos and diazinon. If a Tier 3 farmer were to switch but still had toxicity in their discharge, we would continue to evaluate the cause of that.
So they would remain a Tier 3 if the toxicity was still above a threshold?
That would be at the discretion of the executive officer, but yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Did we get to Mr. Groot yet?
I don't know. Let me just put it on.
Nope. I saw you walk up before, and then okay. Mr. Hensley, and then Darlene Din.
Well, I optimistically started my remarks with good afternoon, but I'll change that to good evening, board members. My name is Norm Groot. I'm the executive director for the Monterey County Farm Bureau. Our organization was founded in 1917 to provide a unified voice for all agricultural commodities produced in Monterey County. I'm here to say today that we have one unified voice in agriculture, and we are all saying we can do it better than what your staff is proposing for the agricultural waiver. Consider that 60% of the leafy greens produced in the United States come from the Salinas Valley. Our nation depends on what is grown here in this valley, and you as directors of this regulatory body hold in your hands the fate of our industry. Do you really want to be known as the board that curtailed local food production because of an unattainable, unscientific, and arbitrary agricultural regulation? There is a broad shift within the agricultural community that more can be done to improve water quality. I think you've seen that demonstrated here and throughout the previous workshops. This is exemplified in the Ag Alternative Proposal, the third-party water quality protection program. This program will provide the best chance for real improvements in water quality because it has the support of the agricultural community behind it. And I'm going to quote from the State Water Resources Control Board concerning third-party activities in the order WQO 2004-003, also known as the Ag Coalition Order. Of utmost concern to this board is the need for an effective and efficient regulatory program that discharges from irrigated agriculture. We note that in the Central Valley, there is an estimated 25,000 farming operations, and that until now, this entire industry has been largely unregulated by the regional board. We strongly believe that in the light of the number of these operations, it is to the benefit of both the regulators and the regulated community to encourage the formation of coalition groups. Not only will communication and regulation be simpler with a smaller number of regulated entities, but the monitoring requirements for groups are much greater and will provide much more useful information. I use that as an example of how something cooperatively can work for an industry that we can back and we can support. 7 years ago, this regional board was the envy of the state because of its progressive attitude of using the regulated community as part of the solution. Today, we stand here a community polarized by your staff proposal that does not include stakeholder input or support from those to be regulated. The true sniff test of this proposal from your staff is with our elected officials. When all the elected officials in Monterey County line up from both political parties up in opposition of this proposed regulation, there is desperately something wrong with this process. So I ask you to support the Ag Alternative moving forward, And I would like to also point out real quick that in the last formal presentation that you received, they talked a lot about the minorities who are impacted within this region. And I'd just like to remind you something that they failed to mention is that those minorities also work in the agricultural community. They depend on agricultural jobs. And without those jobs, they wouldn't have that medium income. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, Mr. Groot?
Oh, sure. Sorry.
One of our two mayors has a question for you.
It, sort of toward the end of your comments, you mentioned that the proposed ag order does not include stakeholder input. What did you mean by that?
Means that the draft that was originally put forth by the staff in February of 2010 and all the iterations afterwards really did not take into account the stakeholder input from the agricultural community.
So you don't believe it's true that there's been a lot of changes through the evolution of this process to get to the document we have? You don't believe that the document we have today reflects changes made as a result of ag and environmental, both stakeholder sort of group interests input?
Of course it reflects changes from the input that was done there, but the original intent was not including any stakeholder input in the original draft in 2010. That was the basis for all the iterations afterwards. And as we look at it from agricultural community, that really doesn't reflect what we are trying to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hensley? Ms. Din? Gordon's gone home. Mr. Tomlinson, I see you standing over there on your cell phone.
I thought we had Darlene Denham.
Darlene is here. Yeah.
I'm sitting here.
Okay,
sorry.
I know. Kind of waiting.
Good evening. I'm going to be brief because of the hour. I changed my comments about 10 times through the last few hours, and what I really wanted to say was, in this process, I think that you as a board have a real opportunity to maybe look at how to take the best of what we've all learned. Through the process, I've spent a lot of time with the conservation community, the elected officials, those in other aspects of areas that work in, I would say, non-traditional ag, and trying to hear input and balance. I also have spent many hours at your office reading public record requests, and what really struck me is that how difficult it is, and I want to speak to Mr. Johnson's, to try to negotiate when you can't speak to each other or when it's fragmented. I think that there's been a lot of meetings, but I think that it's hard when you don't really sit down and really pull your sleeves up and try to work through. I think that's been a problem. And with that, I wanted to say how important it is on how we've looked at trying to improve. And that's how people can learn. And Dr. LaSuerta said an important thing. It's like herding cats, and to try to get people together to figure out how to do very complex solutions. It's just not ag that's herding cats. I think it's us as a community. We have different vernacular. We hear each other differently. We have different frame of reference. I spend a lot of time trying to hear the other side, and that's really hard. So what I'm just asking of you is to look at an opportunity. I know it's been a long time. I understand everybody's point of view, and I think they're all valid. But at some point, maybe we have to try to do a paradigm shift a little different than we have on a regulatory process, and whether it's using some of Dr. LaSuerta's ideas, and I will tell you right now, some of them scare me to death. But at least it's kind of some paths that are different and out of the box, and, you know, it's a new opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Tomlinson.
My name is Rick Tomlinson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the California Strawberry Commission. Thank you for spending so much time here this evening. I have some remarks that maybe I'll have time to get to, but I really wanted to address some of the dialogue you were having about the fear factor, Chairman Young, that you've raised, and what I think is really the core.
Okay.
There's two things. I really welcome the dialogue that I hear from the staff, because that's not what I read in the report. One example, Staff said that Tier 3 is for a farm that has an impaired water body on the farm or immediately adjacent. The language actually says drains into. Drains into, I don't know what that is. I know Mr. Schimmick will have an idea, and I know that Nathan will come up here and lecture you about your legal obligation. And I know that when you get through this process, there's going to be some poor grower who's going to have to go hire an attorney because now they're coming to you through some enforcement action instead of the clarity of a waiver. And so the core is, ag is not afraid of enforcement. That's why we tried to come up with a system of accountability. That's not our concern. That is the concern of some of the stakeholders. They desperately want direct, clear, edge-of-field monitoring for clear enforcement actions. They told you 5 years, 100% compliance with toxicity. Eliminate all surface water toxicity in 5 years. Mr. Schimmick said that when he was standing here. I think he'll acknowledge that. I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. I believe that other stakeholders look at those schedules and they don't read 75% as, you know, okay, maybe. They read it as, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. So I want to avoid that, right? We came up with a proposal that we did not to avoid accountability, but in the zealousness that has been put forward on enforcement, they moved the point of compliance. They moved it from the water body to the farm. Drinking water, quality level water coming off of a farm. The discussion in the previous staff versions, and you know, when you boil it all down, you get to like nutrient standards. You're a drinking water quality level discharge in a surface water discharge from a farm. So it's, again, we're not afraid of the enforcement, the accountability, but we tried to come up with a system that addressed that. The real challenge is that's been a major stumbling block for some of the stakeholders. If you just think for a second, the city of Salinas is all fields, every home. Rain gutters, all those rain gutters, or excuse me, all the gutters for where the rain goes into, the street gutters, if those were all ag ditches, the staff have 100 of those ditches listed as impaired. There's no differentiation between some of those that are a ditch and a creek. There's many of those that are a ditch and a creek, right? It's a creek only when it rains. But you go out to it and look at it, it's a ditch. The person who was talking about impacts to minorities didn't understand the data. It's over half of the sites that are in the Salinas, Santa Maria area that she focused on, she talked about toxicity, are ag ditches. There is no water in those ditches unless it's either raining or unless there's some runoff from the field. It never makes it down to like the Salinas River or the Pajaro River. Mr. Schimmick showed you those images of Salinas River and so forth, but half of the current monitoring sites are in ag ditches that also simultaneously are an ephemeral stream.
Well, but isn't that just as problematic? I mean,
it is, but the tiering shouldn't have been over farms. The tiering should have been over water bodies. Don't you want to clean up the water bodies where there's fish first and worry later about water bodies that are just dry ditches?
Dry ditches that are accumulating waste?
Not necessarily. The pesticides degrade. Some in days, some in weeks, some in months. Right? The whole issue, the example about switching to pesticides, one grower might desperately need to use diazinon, may have no other choice. And so to comply with the water, they may do a retention pond or a filter strip because they still desperately need the pesticide. Others will switch to a different pesticide. The staff made a very good effort to try and come up with best management practices. But that's where you get everybody talking about little different things because they tried to put all the best management practices across the board, universally, for everybody. And that, you know, geographically doesn't work, commodity-wise doesn't work. That's why we came up with this proposal where we need the flexibility for agricultural systems to work, but give you the data to show accountability. So if you need that data to be more transparent or more participatory or something, you know, we beg you to do that, to engage with us on that, but it's the system. That's why when Alex spoke from Congressman Farr's office, 5% of all the land, the irrigated agriculture in Region 3 is strawberries. 50% of the crop value in Region 3 is strawberries. They said Tier 3 is 3% of farms. I hope to God it's not 3% of strawberry farms.